Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
This is really, I think, why we play sport and why we watch sport, is to feel emotion. It's an emotional rush that we're looking for. And we get it, really.
Now, it's episode 40 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. It is a slight change of pace this week as we speak with novelist and All-Ireland minor winning hurler, Tadhg Coakley. Tadhg took early retirement from work as a librarian and then became a writer. And his first novel, The First Sunday in September, is a pretty rare thing in the sense that it is a work of Irish literature with hurling, and indeed sport, at its heart. His latest novel, Whatever It Takes, has been chosen for the Cork One City One Book Initiative for 2020 and is available now. A quick reminder to get in touch with the show, you can email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Over 40 episodes of the show, we've built up a pretty amazing reading list of material from guests, picks and submissions. I've got them all collated on a PDF doc with links to pieces wherever is possible, so if you want to get your hands on it, just give us a shout using any of the aforementioned avenues, and I'll send it on. In the meantime, let's get on with this show. Can I start by asking you to reflect on this description of you by noted member of Hurling's House of Royalty, Nicky English? So, the quote is, "Tadhg was a boot boy from Mallow, a skinhead with a donkey jacket who adopted a very nonchalant attitude to life."
Where did you get that? You did your research.
I'm afraid I did, yeah.
Nicky, I played Nick with hurling with Nicky for 4 years in UCC in the early 80s. And God, it was such a thrill to play hurling with him. You know, he was such an extraordinary hurler and a really nice guy. And he was actually telling that story. It's about our coach, Michael O'Brien, Canon Michael O'Brien. And he was really, that story is, you know, bigging up Canon O'Brien, that I played as a corner forward mostly. But in the middle of a Fitzgibbon Cup final in Croke Park, he just switched me from corner forward to left half back. I actually thought he was taking me off to do a job, really, to Mark Eamon O'Shea, who was the best player that UCD had. So, yeah, Nicky, I never forgave him for that. He owes me big time for that.
So, I mean, your hurling bona fides are pretty strong.
Well, I played a lot of hurling when I was young. I was lucky enough, I came from a good club, Mallow, in North Cork, and I went to a hurling school, St. Comas College in Fermoy. And we won a Hearty Cup and in All-Ireland Colleges, and I was just kind of coming into that team. I was very young. I was 16 then. And then when I went to college, I actually didn't really want to play much hurling anymore. I had other diversions, if I can put it like that, and interests. But I got a message that Michael O'Brien, Canon O'Brien, wanted me to go down to the Mardike. And, you know, 4 years later, we had won 4 Fitzgibbon Cups, and I had been part of an All-Ireland winning Cork minor team as well. And I had played under 21 hurling from Cork. And I was down to Michael O'Brien, really, who saw something in me, I think, as a player I didn't really see myself.
You didn't stick it out till senior then?
No, I didn't. I wasn't dedicated enough, number one, Gavin. I think I wasn't really good enough. Probably not quite big enough, but you can be a very good hurler. You don't have to be a very big man to be a very good hurler. But I didn't really have the dedication. I didn't have you have to stick it out, really, as a sportsman. And when I got into my mid-20s and so on, I wasn't really that interested in hurling, to tell you the truth.
Can I ask an ignorant question? Can I ask what a donkey jacket is?
Well, you're far too young to know what a donkey jacket is. It's actually, it was a very fashionable piece of clothing at the time. It's a kind of an overcoat, dark navy in colour. Sometimes it had a little bit of leather thing. It's a long enough coat. My one didn't have leather. But I thought it was really, I was the bee's knees. There was a one shop, a McCarthy shop in the Colquay in Cork. You could buy 2 things, donkey jackets and Doc Martin boots. So I had a pair of both of them. I was weak for myself when I was in college, Gavin. I thought I was fantastic.
Did that leave you later in life, or was that exclusive to college?
No, it left me. And it wasn't really, I didn't really think I was great either. certainly from a sporting perspective, I didn't have the kind of confidence either that, you know, people like Mickey weren't overly confident or anything, but yeah, he knew really. I mean, you knew at an early age, you couldn't not know if you were as good as Mickey English, that how good you were and how good you were going to be. But mm-hmm. I didn't really know. I didn't. It was all a way of kind of hiding really behind the donkey jacket.
That Nicky English description of your bohemian dress and approach sounds like it would square pretty well with a writer, if I can indulge in some stereotyping, Tig. But it did take you a while before you became a published writer. Can you maybe explain what happened?
Yeah, well, it did really. And that, I'd say, was partly down to, I mean, when I was in my early 20s, and I would often be the only one, and this is a college team now, I'd often be the only one reading a book on the bus, which I got slagged about, of course. But I did, I think, always want to write, but I didn't have the confidence. And the kind of people I was reading were, you know, people like Joseph Conrad or Anthony Burgess, John Updike, and to me, they weren't even human. They were like gods. So there was no way I could ever, you know, be a writer. But I was wrong about that. When I did eventually start to meet writers and so on, they're just normal people. Some of them are brilliant, obviously. But no, it was something I always had in my head. And then in my mid-50s, when I was heading towards an early retirement from my job in CIT in Cork, I said, look, you better do this now. You really regret if you're in your 60s or 70s or 80s and you haven't at least tried to write a book. So I started to write a book, a crime novel. It ended up being called Whatever It Takes. And then I signed up for an MA in creative writing in UCC. And my first book, The First Sunday in September, came directly out of that. And I effectively became a writer. I came out as a writer at the age of 55. I can call it.
There'll be so many people listening to this, and perhaps one person presenting this who feels quite similar, you know, that they'll feel that they love reading, that they could be a writer, but oh my God, look at all the great writers around. I mean, I can't hold a torch to that at all. How does that process come about? How do you get yourself to your desk? How do you start writing? How do you keep writing? And then how do you get things published?
Well, the first thing was the MA was useful to me because it gave me a structure. I was used to working, getting up, going to work first thing in the morning. So I replicated that during the MA. And, you know, I got up and started writing, and you have lots of deadlines as part of the MA. You are part of a community of writers, which I would recommend to anybody. You don't have to do an MA in creative writing, but I think it is important to feel like you're a writer, even if you haven't had anything published, to feel that, yeah, I'm a writer, I just haven't been published yet. So join a writer's group, you know, hang out with writers, follow them home if you have to, whatever you have to do. And, you know, and start writing, really, and then start showing it to people, because it's easy enough to sit at home and write and have a hobby of writing poetry or prose. But showing it to people and exposing yourself, taking the rejections, taking the criticism that people will say who don't like it, and picking yourself back up, you know, and keep going, really. That's the main thing, you know. And someone like you, certainly, who's young enough to make a go of it, keep going. Don't stop.
How do you find the confidence? Or you mentioned earlier that you didn't have the confidence initially to start writing. So how do you find it?
Well, eventually, my kind of need to be a writer, and, you know, I realized it's now or never, it pushed beyond the lack of confidence. You have to keep going. It does a certain amount of desire there. You know, I wanted to be a writer, so that this was my object of desire. And I said, well, look, I better just do it and keep going. And then, you know, some things you write are good, some aren't. And in the MA, you know, I did pretty well within the group of writers who were there. And I realized when I wrote the thesis for the MA, which was a series of short stories built around an All-Ireland hurling final, I realized then that I had made a good start on a book of stories. I had about 10 written at that stage. And I said, well, look, keep going now. Don't, just because the MA is over, don't stop. Keep going. And I did. And I finished it, sent it to Mercia Press. They had a competition called the Mercer Fiction Prize. It ended up being longlisted, then shortlisted for that. And I didn't win it, but I got a phone call one day, just a year after my MA, finishing the MA, saying they wanted to publish it. So, yeah, that was a big boost.
Yeah, tell us about that book, because I described it in the intro as a pretty rare thing in the sense that it's a work of Irish literature that has hurling and indeed sport at its heart.
Yeah, it is. It's very rare, really. It's the only GAA novel that I know of. There are other sports books by Paul Howard and various people, but and there's a lot of poetry about sport in Ireland and a lot of theatre, but very little fiction. So in a way, it was the book I always would have liked to read in my 20s and 30s. And I said, well, look, I better have a go at this. It started out with one character. Like, you don't have to have a plan for a whole novel to start it. I never had a plan, even for my second book, the crime novel. I just had a character. I started writing about him. And in the first book, I had an idea about writing a father watching his son playing a match. Well, first of all, I had an idea about a father watching his son, and they're estranged. So he couldn't go to the son. And then I thought, well, what about if he's watching in a hurling match? What about if it's an All-Ireland final? And what about if he gave the boy up for adoption as a baby? And that's the reason he can't go and congratulate him after the game. And I wrote a story, it's called Dukas, with that premise. And then I realized, well, there's another story here from the point of view of the son who has been adopted and isn't sure about his identity. And there was another story from the point of view of the mother who really wants to meet this young man and her life has been hard. So then I had three stories linked together, and then I had other characters. I thought, well, I'd like to put in a real diehard GAA person who maybe has some kind of a sad backstory. And then I thought, I'd like to have someone looking at the game who hasn't a clue what's going on. So I invented this English woman who's pregnant and her boyfriend is a big Cork supporter. And then it just grew from there. There was more characters, more stories, and I just kept going.
When you talk there about the idea of a father watching a son, I think that may lead us on to one of your picks, which is a poem by Paul Durkin called Sport. So can you tell us about the poem and why you picked it?
Paul is an amazing writer. He's a wonderful poet, and he's an unlikely person, really, if you met him, to be writing about sport. I met him once or twice and spoke to him about my own hurling career. But one of the things that I think is amazing about sport is that it has a lot of family ties. Not for everybody, but I've spoken to a lot of people, sports fans or players, for a book I'm working on at the moment, a memoir. And I've asked a lot of them why or how they were initiated into sport. At some point in your life and in my life, we were initiated as a switch was flicked inside us that made us sports fans. And very often it relates to something to do with the family, a father bringing a son to a game or a daughter. It could be siblings playing a game, an older brother or sister, maybe who's a great sports person. And even if you take a book like a great book that came out there last year, Recovering by Richie Sadler, you know, he writes very movingly about when he was young, all he wanted was his father to watch him playing football. That's all the only thing he wanted. So, and this is very much in that mold. Paul is a very funny writer as well. He's very quirky. And I'm just going to read the last couple of verses of it. It's in a great book of called Everything to Play For, which is 99 poems about sport. It's a book of Irish sports poetry. And this is one of the better ones, I think. So I'm just going to read the last two verses and maybe talk about them. So the premise is that Paul is 21. It's his 21st birthday, in fact, and he's playing a Gaelic football match and his father is watching on the sideline and he really wants to impress him. I suppose the kind of twist is that he's playing football, Gaelic football, for the Grange Gorman Mental Hospital team, who are playing against the Mullingar Mental Hospital team. So this is the poem. This is the end of the poem. To my surprise, I did not flinch in the goals. He was playing in goals. I made three or four spectacular saves, diving full stretch to turn a certain goal around the corner, leaping high to tip another certain goal over the bar for a point. It was my knowing that you were standing on the sideline that gave me the necessary motivation. That will to die that is as essential to sportsmen as to artists. More than anybody, it was you I wanted to mesmerize. And after the game, Grange Gorman Mental Hospital, having defeated Mullingar Mental Hospital by 14 goals and 30 points to 3 goals and 10 points, sniffing your approval, you shook hands with me. Well played, son. I may not have been mesmeric, But I had not been mediocre. In your eyes, I had achieved something at last. On my 21st birthday, I had played on a winning team, the Grange Garman Mental Hospital team. Seldom, if ever again, in your eyes, was I to rise to these heights. So it's very funny the way he describes the patients of the hospitals, but it's very moving underneath. And in a way, you know, a lot of people who take up sport and who are serious players, they do it really to impress their mother or their father or other kind of older people, uncles or older siblings and so on. They're very, very strongly connected. And hence the great emotion in sport, which is the big draw of sport.
Hmm. So at risk of asking a blindingly obvious question and leaving aside the rhythm of the words and the words themselves, what makes that good sports writing in your view?
I think it's very true to sport because, you know, there's an awful lot of facts and details about sport. And we need those. They enhance our intimacy with sport. So if you the more you know about sport, the more intimate you feel with it. And then the more you emotions you feel then when you watch a game. So let's say your brother was playing for the Irish football team, a soccer team, and I call it football. Let's say it's your brother. So you're very intimate with this game now. It's a huge kind of thing. Let's say it's your cousin. You're still intimate, but not as intimate. Let's say it's somebody from your club. So the more you know about these people, the more intimate you feel with the game and the more emotion is generated. And this is really, I think, why we play sport and why we watch sport is to feel emotion. It's an emotional rush that we're looking for. And we get it, really.
Mm. How have you found watching sport? I know it's a pretty diminished thing when there are no crowds there, but how have you found watching sport amid a pandemic?
Well, I have to tell you a funny story now, really. I spent most of 2019 writing a memoir about my own take on sport. Various essays, really, about different aspects of sport and 42 that I was good enough to publish one of those. But so I was really immersed in sport for almost all of 2019. And when the year turned, I was working on a crime novel. I said, I'm not going to watch sport for a while. I said, I'm going to take a break from it, a sabbatical, and see how that feels. And then the pandemic hit, so there was no sport anyway. So it didn't really matter. My experiment failed miserably, basically, because I wanted to see how I'd feel about not watching sport. But it was forced on me anyway. So I watched a game, a live game in January. It was a Gaelic football match in Páirc Uí-Chaoimh. It was a doubleheader. The women, Cork footballers and men's, were playing together. They were playing in the doubleheader for the first time ever. So I went along to that. And the only reason I went was the Irish Examiner asked me to go down and write something about it. And the next live game I watched was the FA Cup final about 2 weeks ago. Mm. So I didn't watch any sport even after the kind of lockdown finished. I didn't watch any of the... There was a huge nostalgia kind of fest during the lockdown, but I was living in a house where there was no TV. So I didn't watch any of that. I'm not really into nostalgia at all in sport, actually. Even things like Italian 90, when Jack Charlton died there lately, it didn't really move me at all. I mean, I was totally gripped in 1990, but looking back on it, it just doesn't seem the same to me at all. But I have to say, watching the FA Cup final, the only reason I watched it, we were on holidays in Kerry, and my nephew was there, Thomas. He's a big football fan. He said, Ty, we'll come in and watch the FA Cup final. Otherwise, I wouldn't have bothered. It was Arsenal and Chelsea, obviously. I'm a United fan, so I had no skin in the game. But I found it very moving watching it because it was so beautiful. I couldn't believe how good the players were. I couldn't believe their skill, their movement. I couldn't believe how intricate the passing was. I couldn't believe the speed of the ball, the speed of thought of the players. I was kind of mesmerized. It was like... And it was only 6 months since I'd seen a game. I'd been watching football since 1967, but it was like I'd forgotten, really. And it was, that was a really breathtaking, and it kind of got me going again. Back to my memoir, my book of essays, which I'm going to return to now and try and finish that.
Maybe just as the lockdown began and we realised sport wouldn't be back for a while, and when it came back, it would be behind closed doors. I was lamenting it because I did think I was more into the spectacle of football and the noise around it and the stories that are teased out in the media around it than the game itself. But I have to say, since it's resumed, even in empty stadiums, I am more absorbed by the sport itself and the action than I thought I was. I don't know why there was that dissonance initially, but I'm definitely more into the football than I thought I was.
No, it's very interesting. You know, Joyce Carol Oates, who's a great writer, she has a very interesting book about boxing, about her intimacy with boxing. Her father used to take her, and she's a most unlikely boxing fan, but her father used to take her to prize fights when she was young. And she writes about the boxers. Now, she doesn't really think that boxing is sport. I disagree with her about that. But she talks about the boxers in a way that they go to a place, and she calls it a place beyond words, which is a brilliant phrase for sport. And she says they're subject to the strange will of the fans, like that almost the fans are willing on the players. So it is a really heady thing to be among 50 or 60,000 people at a big game and to have a part in that. And I think, you know, that's a big part of live sport. You know, the fans have a huge part to play, I think, in those games. But in a way, without the fans, it's only the game. It's only the football. Now we're seeing it's purer in a way. It's different. It's not the same. And maybe it's not as good, but there's nothing to distract us now from the football.
Yeah. Do you watch games with fake crowd noise on TV?
I do, but that was the only game I've seen in 6 months. So that was my first experience of it was. But I have to say as well that it depends on the games. And like, I don't like comparing different sports, but football was the first game I played. I saw George Best when I was 7, and you know, the switch was flicked inside me. I couldn't believe, you know, what he could do and how beautiful he was. So for me personally, I'm not saying football is the most beautiful game, but to me personally, it is. I find it the most beautiful game. So that really, you know, that has stayed with me ever since, and I'd kind of forgotten it really until I watched the FA Cup final again. And I think the reason I find it so beautiful is that when I was playing football, and I only played junior football, and I only played seriously until I was 25, but I felt most at home on a football pitch more than any other pitch with a ball at my feet. I really felt comfortable, and it's a very nice feeling. I didn't feel that comfortable in any other aspect of my life as a young person, but playing football, I really, really did feel good.
That aesthetic quality of football, I think, is one of the main topics of another of your picks, Tadhg, which is called Prosinecki. It's a short story by Adrian Duncan that appeared in a summer 2018 issue of Stinging Fly. Can you tell us about this piece?
Yeah, it is really. It's a very interesting short story. First of all, there's a very short time arc in the story. It covers a very short period of time, so there's a great intensity in it that you don't really get in novels. You can get in small moments in novels. But I think one of the interesting things about sport is how it distorts time. And I have one story in my book called 5 Seconds, which takes place over a period of 5 seconds, the length of one puck of a ball in a match. So the story covers a single moment. But in sport, a moment can last a lifetime. And you often hear people like Klopp and Arteta talk about moments in games. So this is a very intense moment. The story is narrated by a footballer during the game. He's a good character for a short story because he's an outsider. He's not really embedded in the community. He's suffering a certain amount of loss. He's at the end of his football career, so there's a very good character of voice. And he does come to this realization. He sees somebody in the crowd, and he realizes that his thought, his philosophy of the aesthetics of football has been wrong all this time. So I'm going to read a very short passage of it. It's during a break in a game. It's a night football game in the lower leagues in Northern England. And it's told from the point of view of this midfielder. He's from inner city Leeds, but he's near the end of his career now. He's coming back from one injury too many, and he's thinking back to when he was at his peak. The goalkeeper is injured, so there's a lull in the game. And he's thinking back to one game he played in particular in the German league. He used to play in Germany when he could do amazing things that he can't really do now. And he created this beautiful goal, which is described in the story, and there's a great climax. And this is what follows. As I jogged back to the centre circle, the same thoughts I always had when I was playing well in Brandenburg appeared. That I could run like this forever. That there was no limit to my Cartesian aptitude. That I was a conqueror here. That I was showing my football culture to be finer, and that I was ready to return and present myself again in England, the only place where any of this had worked or made proper sense to me. It was the only place where the admiration was appropriate. And as my heart pounded and I tracked down the kickoff, I thought, it is the only admiration that will satisfyingly last beyond my career, where I might be recognized for my deeds as an aging, broad-shouldered and bronzed ex-pro in my 40s and 50s and 60s, entering a cafe perhaps in some quiet West Midlands town, or a restaurant in Newcastle, or the clubhouse of a cricket club on a quiet Tuesday afternoon in a suburb in Northern Leeds. So you have this great object of desire again here in this story, as we had in the Paul Durkin poem as well. And all good stories have this. But of course, he's not going to achieve that object of desire. He's not going to be recognized as a great player. And the damning realization he comes to is that really his aesthetic, the beauty he thought was important in football, wasn't the most important thing at all.
In what ways, why did he realize that it's not as important as he believed it was?
He was obsessed with this player called Przanecki, who's a real player, by the way, and he's a manager now, I think. And he loved the way that he played. So he thought the physical beauty of Przanecki was the kind of the ultimate, really. But he realized in that moment of a game, when he can't do the beautiful things anymore, but he can still do the important things, he realized that it wasn't the beauty at all. But the funny thing is that Adrian Duncan, in the language of the story, it's kind of mirroring the beauty of football, even though it's a story about the beauty not being the most important thing. And there's a great podcast where Wendy Erskine, the great short story writer from Belfast, reads the short story. It's on the Stingy Fly website. She reads it with Danny Denton, who's the editor of the Stingy Fly, and they both talk about the importance as writers to cut a lot of the beautiful stuff out of our stories. It's like the step over looks great, really, but it's not the most important thing. The most important thing is, as this narrator says, doing the moral thing for the team. And the ending is brilliant because, just going to read the last sentence, the ending is because he slows the writing down, and it's like watching a beautiful moment in a game in slow motion from two or three different angles, kind of in a brilliant documentary. So this is the last sentence in the story. The ball begins to slow into its languid arc. And as our striker's body coils and as his eyes wince shut, bringing him into the great pre-impact dark that every footballer knows, I gasp deeply once more at the impotent, incidental and unforgivable beauty of it all. And that really sums up sport in many ways for me. The tension of that moment, and you know it in the game. It's almost like time slows down. The ball goes across, or there's a shot taken, a free kick, and is it going to go in? Isn't it? Will the goalie get to it? Will the header go inside the post or outside the post? The sense of tension in that moment is absolutely riveting, and it's one of the great attractions, I think, of sport, this tension of what's going to happen.
Yeah, it had never occurred to me, and I've read this a few times since it was published a couple of years ago, it has never occurred to me that it might be almost a kind of meditation on writing itself, that all these beautiful phrases and this great imagery that I'm using are not, it's not pragmatic to use them. They're not effective. So I have to kind of cut them out. Like, the impotent, incidental and unforgivably beautiful is a good comment on every writer's ego there's ever been.
Absolutely. And also, in a way, sport. I mean, we're talking about sport. You're making your life livelihood through sport. And I'm spending a lot of time thinking and writing about sport. And in a way, like, we learned during this pandemic that sport is not really that important, but it also is important. And the beauty is unforgivable because there's no great reason why sport should matter to so many people. You know, why 1.5 million people should watch an All-Ireland football final or anything like that and be so caught up in it. Like the emotion of the Liverpool fans this summer, for example, this 30 years of hurt. Why should it mean so much that a team in a city that you might never go to wins a championship, you know? But it does. Jeez, yeah. It does.
Yeah, that's because I look back even what I was tweeting and what I was writing in March and April at the height of the pandemic, saying, you know, I was saying this stuff like, there's no moral reason to bring back football at the moment, given what's going on in in England. This is specifically in related to the Premier League and all this stuff. And now, having had sport back, particularly in the last couple of weeks with the Champions League and the World Snooker Championship and really important games, I'm like, what a crock of shit that was. We need this more than ever.
We do. We really do. And, you know, we need it as fans. It connects us, I think, a lot. I read an interview lately with David Byrne, the front man in Talking Heads, and he's been asked about what's music for, what's the point of music. And he said it connects people, and sport really connects people. And I was living in Carrigtool during the lockdown, and I remember when it was lifted, and I saw the kids going back to sport, to the GA pitch and the soccer pitch there, and they're cycling along, and they got the hurley in the backpacks, and they're meeting all their friends. Like, sport gives us that, you know. It does really connect people. It is powerful in that sense, so I think we do need it, really.
Yeah. I want to circle back to something I said earlier on and in the intro, that your first novel is rare in the sense that it is a work of Irish literature with sport at its heart. It's been kind of pretty absent historically. Like, if you look at the canon, the heavyweights, not to sound too much like a football pundit here type, but your Yeats's, your Joyce's, your Beckett's, never really been too bothered about sport. I was wondering... Like, we've discussed it on a previous edition of this podcast with Kieran Cunningham, who reckons that maybe there's a little bit of snobbery towards it, because here was, like, if the writer's job was to take down official Ireland and its pillars of the church and Fianna Fáil, that maybe sport and particularly the GAA was too associated with it. So I'd love to, if you have any thoughts on why sport hasn't really been a feature, been to the forefront of Irish writing, to the extent as you might imagine it would have.
No, it's true. It's true. We were obsessed with sport and we're obsessed with literature. And especially in fiction, there's been very little of it. There are a lot of plays and poems, as I said. But I suppose I think there are a few reasons. I get asked this a lot. One, I think, is on the supply side of books about sport, a fiction of the sport. You know, if you take 100 writers out there and survey them, how many of them are really interested in sport? They want to spend a year or 5 years writing a novel about sport. You might get 10%, 10 out of 100 might be interested, or even less. So that's 90 writers straight away who are never going to kind of do this. Then on the demand side, you have to get a book past an editor and a publishing house. And, you know, again, a lot of editors wouldn't be big sports fans. I pitched my first book to one publishing house, and the editor was very nice about the writing. And he said, this is a real stretch. He said, when I was at school and we played football, I was the football, he said. So I can't see myself editing a sports novel at all. And even if you take that short story, Prasenechki, that was edited and published by Distinguished Fly when Sally Rooney was the editor. And she's a big sports fan, and you know, she incorporated it into Normal People, and she's written about sport. You know, she wrote an article a few years ago about cultural icons of the year. I think it was in 2018, and one of the cultural icons she listed was Mohamed Salah. So, but if it was a different editor in the Stinging Fly at the time, you know, maybe that story would never have been published. It would never have got out there. And then there's on the demand side, you know, 80% of fiction is read by women. And one of the books, if we have time, we'll talk about, it's called The Natural by Ross Reyes. And when he wrote this, it's a book about a gay professional footballer in England. And his publisher, and he's spoken openly about this. His publisher were Penguin, and he was a very successful author. It was his third novel. His first two did very well. But Penguin said to him, Ross, I don't think we're going to publish this because we don't know how to sell it to women because it's about football. But at the same time, we don't know how to sell it to football supporters because it's about a gay man. So, no, thankfully, it did get published by Jonathan Cape. And even sports fans, like, you're very interested in a lot of things to do with sport. You're a writer, and I'm very interested in it as well. But if you surveyed 100 guy at the Cork City Sligo Rovers game last Friday night, you know, young lads, how many of that 100 would really read a sports novel? Maybe 10 again, you know. So there are kind of difficulties there in terms of bringing it to fruition. In a lot of people, and this might really hurt your feelings now, Gavin, but, you know, a lot of people don't like sport. I meet people all the time and they say, why did you write a book about sport? you know, why didn't you write about a love story or something like that? And sport is kind of almost ubiquitous in our society, you know. It's lots of newspapers, lots of TV channels and radio, news stations. It covers a huge amount of sport. A friend of mine who's gay, when the book came out, said, you know, Tiger said, a lot of my friends who are gay friends, they don't like sport. I said, boy. And he said, well, he said, when they were young, their fathers wanted them, pushed them into sport to kind of make men of them, to toughen them up. So they really don't like it. And then you have other elements of sport, which, you know, we can talk about maybe when we talk about a natural, the competitive, the aggression in sport, the win or lose element that a lot of people don't like. You know, the gentle people don't really enjoy that, the toxic masculinity. So there are other issues there, really, how people don't really want to read about sport. And then there are technical issues of actually writing sports fiction as well, you know, that John McGahan talked about as a thing called the double artifice, that you have to overcome the artificial world of writing and of reading a book, and then you have the artificial world of sport and all the rules and so on. So there's lots of reasons, but even having said that, John McGahan himself and other writers like Adrian Duncan have overcome those things. So I think it can be done, and I wish there was more of it. I really do.
Yeah, just a couple of things on what you said. I'm always amazed at my capacity for sympathy for these people who don't like sport. It always makes me feel better about myself, how I can feel so sorry for these benighted people. The other thing is, I had no idea Sally Rooney had written about Mohamed Salah. Where can we find that?
It's in The Guardian. If you look her up, it's in The Guardian. The great thing about Sally is that, you know, I think Adrian's told me once that when he was writing the story, when she was editing it, and she edited and commissioned it for the magazine, they had a lot of talk about midfielders in particular, you know, that. And she writes very movingly about Mohamed Salah. If you look it up, she writes, like me, she's amazed. And I don't know if she played sport the way that I did, but she's amazed at the kind of beauty and the intricacy and the speed of thought of footballers, especially. And there's one expression she used that when she watches Mohamed Salah, she said, it's like looking at the stars. She said, it makes me feel small. Not in a bad way either. She said, it's kind of comfortable to feel small. But and that's the way I felt when I watched the FA Cup final. And I was really taken aback because I wasn't expecting it. At 59 now, I've seen all these games. Oh, yeah, I'll watch the FA Cup final and not care less. I mean, it was kind of rooting for Arsenal a little bit. But, it's amazing. And that she classified a footballer as a cultural icon, I thought was very moving, actually.
Yeah, there's also a great story written by her. I think The Economist might have published it or some such website, with Robbie Brady's goal in Lille against Italy in Euro 2016 as its background. We're trading a couple of good recommendations there. But another of your recommendations you have mentioned is A Natural, a novel by Ross Raisin. I will hold my ignorant hands up and say I've never heard of it. So can you tell us a little bit more about it?
Yeah, it's a great novel, really. It works on all sorts of levels. And not that it's important that it's about sport, really. It was published in 2017, and I already mentioned a little bit how difficult it was for him to get it published. So the story, it's about a young professional footballer in England. His name is Tom Pearman, and he's been sent down to a club in a lesser division. He's a very good prospect. He played for the England youths, but you know the way these Premier League clubs send down young fellas to toughen them up and get them, you know, a bit stronger and a bit able to deal with the Stokes on a Monday night and so on. But he's coming to terms with being gay. He's a gay man, and you know he has to hide it, especially in such a macho kind of homophobic world like professional football. So outwardly, he's a hero. He's worshipped by the fans. The manager thinks he's great. He's a great, skillful player. But the struggle is going on, an internal struggle, and that compels us to read on about him. And he's in love with a young groundskeeper who's a former footballer as well. So he has a great sense of shame. He can't come out to his family. His sister knows he's gay and so on. So there's two other main characters in the book as well. And this is a very good device, I think, by Ross. He has two other characters, their points of view, which gives us a break from Tom as well, which we need from time to time. One is the top player in the club, a man called Easter. His surname is Easter. And he's suffered a double leg break. So he's not playing, so he's kind of home hanging around, wondering will he be okay after the injury. And the third character is his wife, Leah, who's kind of put upon. He's kind of dominating her, and she has a small baby, and she's struggling as well. So it's a brilliantly written novel. Like, one of the technical difficulties in writing a book about sports people like this is, like, if you were writing a novel about a camogie team, for example, a successful camogie team like Slough Neil or the Dublin camogie team. So you have this group of people, they're young people, they're fit, they're healthy, they're embedded in their families, they're embedded in their communities, they look great, you know, young sports people look great, and they know they look great. They have a great sense of purpose. They're very determined. They're very focused. If they want a job, they get a job. If they want a boyfriend, girlfriend, they can have a boyfriend, girlfriend. And all of this makes them very unsuitable for putting in a novel or a short story because they're too good, you know. So you have to find some way of putting them outside society, of having them as a kind of submerged character, as Frank O'Connor said. There's a very good sports novel by a Swedish writer called Fredrik Backman. It's called A Scandal. It's about a young team, an ice hockey team in northern Sweden. And ostensibly, these are kind of very well-adjusted young men playing ice hockey. But one of them is a rapist. He's raped a girl. Another is gay, and he's hiding this as well. And another then has a twist. He's an immigrant, and he's a sense of being an outsider. So that really works in this, the sense of Tom, of being an outsider and having a kind of hidden inner life, really. But he does it really well. He uses a lot of new media. The character Easter's online all the time. And there's a great sense of tension because there's always the danger that someone is going to find out that he's gay and he'll be outed and his football career will be ruined. And of course, it also tackles the elephant in the room, about all this, which is the issue of homophobia in sport. The toxic masculinity that's endemic in male football, you know, and it's not there in women's sport, for example. And how, in a way, we're all complicit in this a little bit as sports fans, you know, the sexism in sport, the kind of greed, the cheating that goes on. And you know, David Walsh talking about that on the show there a couple of weeks ago. The corruption that takes place in the administration of sport, and you've written a lot about that. The whole issue of Qatar, for example, you know, that people are dying, literally dying at this moment so that we can enjoy the World Cup in 2022 in Qatar. And I remember the World Cup in Argentina in 1976. You're too young to remember that, but I was 15 and I was entranced by it. It really was an amazing spectacle. And the Dutch team and the Argentinian team and everything to do with it, you know, but that was a sports washing, really, of what was happening in a stadium down the road. We were watching one stadium with the World Cup final or whatever, but in a stadium a few kilometres away, people were dying, and it was a concentration camp. And the whole junta, the government, were using that as a way of directing attention away from the people who they were murdering, you know, to watch sports. So, and I think, in fairness to Ross Raisin, he confronts that dark side of sport. He's still, you know, a big football fan, a big Bradford City fan, but he does take that on, you know. And it's something that I want to do as well in my memoir. My own kind of personal behavior, my own attitude towards women athletes, for example.
Is it a constant tension that you're navigating, Ty, between the spectacle and the aesthetic of sport and the really rather grubby business of it all? Because, like, as far as I'm concerned, like, the more you learn about how sport is staged, how it's played, and largely why it's played, the more you grow to dislike it sometimes.
Yeah, there is really, Gavin. But at the same time, and this is the kind of badly quote a scene in a film that you probably have seen, is, you know, ultimately, you know, when I watch those young men playing the FA Cup final, ultimately it's a boy playing with a ball. You know, sport really is a game. It's a form of play. It is innocent, really, at its center. Now, it is corrupted by other people, certainly, I think, at its real core, it's a form of play. It's a form of connecting with people. And if we treat it right, and if we have the right attitude towards it, there's no reason why it can't really be, you know, the great thing we all thought it was when we were children. We have to curb our cynicism too, really. We have to push back against it.
I think that, and then, but maybe this is the insidious trick of sports washing and so on. So I'll slip into that mode of thought and be just, you know, totally in awe of some things I see and totally thrilled by it. And then, you know, you think about it and you feel kind of guilty for feeling that way because, wait a minute, that's how, you know, these repressive regimes who are pumping money into this want you to feel? Is this, maybe I'm going off on too wild.
We need it too, Gavin. Like we need to feel good. We need to look at wonderful games and to feel the excitement and to, even if it's only pretend, that we need to feel that kind of innocence that we get from a film or, you know, any other piece of art, really. And I do think that sport is a type of art form which, you know, has great power of diverting us. But I mean, how I think a book works really is that when we ultimately read a book, a novel, a great novel, for example, we become the characters in that book. We transform ourselves through empathy and imagination into those characters. And we do the same in sport. So when Sally Rooney is watching Mohamed Salah do those amazing things, she becomes him, you know, and she feels better about herself and she feels like one of the stars, that she's in the stars as well. And I think this, it's a kind of magic, it's a leisure demand kind of, you know, that's behind it. But it really does happen. I think it's very real. That's one of the reasons I'm a sports fan. No, and the word fan and the word fanatic are very closely aligned. But if we can be more fans and less fanatics, I think we'd be better off.
Yeah. Briefly, the fourth and final of your picks is another novel called A Throwback Special. Can you maybe tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, and it's my favorite sports book, Gavin. I really love it. And it's because it's kind of very innocent and it's great fun. It's a very funny book. It's a very well-written book by an American writer called Chris Batchelder. And it's very different from A Natural, for example. And in this, there's no sport. It's about sports fans, really. It's actually, the story is, very briefly, every autumn in the United States, in the Midwest, 22 middle-aged men gather in a hotel, in a cheap motel, to reenact a play in the NFL from 1985. So that's the setup. And it's a shocking play. It really happened. It was between the Washington Redskins and the New York Giants. And it was shown live on TV. It was a Monday night game. O.J. Simpson was one of the commentators. And the play became known as the Throwback Special. So what happened was the Redskins quarterback, Joe Theismann, handed the ball to a running back. And the running back dummied a run, but he actually threw the ball back to Theismann as well. And this was the play. And he was going to do something else with it. But one of the New York Giants, a man called Lawrence Taylor, landed on Theismann's leg and he smashed the leg to kind of smithereens. And you can watch this on YouTube if you have a strong stomach. So the book is about these 22 men coming together and reenacting the play. And it's a bizarre kind of thing to do only in America, but it's not really about the play. It's about being a middle-aged man, really, being a sports fan, being past your best. And that's one of the reasons I love it most, because you have yet to reach your middle age, but I'm past it. So, but he does something brilliant in the book in that he doesn't really write about each of the men as individuals. He kind of groups them all together. The point of view flits from one to the other in a way that creative writing teachers would frown upon. It's called talking heads, and it can confuse the reader, but he does it deliberately to emphasize that the group isn't really a group of 22 people anymore. It's a single entity, like a team. And I mean, it's very funny. And you know how funny groups of men can be. You know, you've been in groups of Irish football fans at away at games and so on. And it's great fun. We have to remember that sport is great crack. Like it's, and these guys are very funny, you know. And there are some darker moments there as well. But I just read one very short snippet, and they're all complaining about they got a bad back and the wife is giving them a chip. And so here's a quick few paragraphs. Trent had come home to find his daughter going down on a boy. Jeff had come home to find his daughter going down on a girl. Andy had come home to find his kid doing like this with an aerosol can of whipped cream. Yeah, whip it, said George, the public librarian. Tommy had come home to find his dog had eaten a package of diapers. The surgery was $2,500 and now he had pet insurance. Nate had come home to find his wife Skyping with a man in a military uniform. Bald Michael came home to find his son hurting a cat, and so on. You get the drift.
we're turning for home, Ty. We've got our three stock questions. First up is the most interesting place you've been with work.
Well, the most interesting place, I think the most amazing sports event I was at, and I won't really say any more, I was at the Miracle at Medina. So that was an amazing event. But the most interesting place, I was at a baseball game in Hiroshima 2 years ago. And it was a really great event. I mean, it blew my mind. It was all families there. They were all eating during the whole game. I love baseball because it's so slow and it goes on. But the attitude, you know, this elderly kind of Japanese couple near us adopted us. And every time I was there with my wife, and every time the beer person came around, because they were bringing beer around, of course, there was no problem drinking beer at a Japanese baseball game in the stands. They would call the beer person to come to my wife and myself to get us another beer. But it was a brilliant experience, and it was a very, very happy occasion. You know, all these families, 3-4 generations sometimes of people watching it, it really was wonderful.
Am I being hopelessly innocent and being amazed by the fact that here's America's pastime being played in Hiroshima?
I know, yeah, absolutely. And, you know, the funny thing is that all the names on the backs of the jerseys are in English as well. They don't use Japanese, really. But it was like being, you know, at some level of being at a game in New York City or Detroit or somewhere else on a sunny summer's evening. And there's something particularly lovely, kind of bucolic about the game of baseball, the pace of it and all to do with it. And, you know, that it's every second goal. So it's very different from a lot of other sports. So if your team is in, they can score, and then they're out, they have to try and stop the other team. So there's lots of kind of switches and cheering and everything. It really was a great spectacle.
Mm. Most interesting person you met with work?
The most interesting person, I think I met at the Stowe Literary Festival a couple of years ago. I met Richard Ford, who's written a really great novel called The Sports Writer, about a sports writer and himself and his wife, and she's a professional golfer. And we sat at a bar, and it was one of these lucky meetings. He was going off to do a reading, so we only had about half an hour together, but we spoke about short stories. We spoke about politics. We spoke about America and Ireland. And it really was very, very special, because one of the reasons I think I'm a writer is that I read Richard Ford. And I told him this, of course, and he was kind of poo-pooing it. He's probably used to these wannabe fans coming up to him. But he actually sat beside me. I didn't sat beside him in my defense. But it was a great conversation. And, you know, they say sometimes you shouldn't meet your heroes, but I think you should.
The most difficult question of all, Tadhg, if you had to pick one of those four works that you submitted to us that you had written, which one would it be and why?
It would be the Throwback Special, really. It's a very special book. It's so funny. I find it difficult enough to write funny. And it's about fans. It's about our relation. It's not about sport. It's about how we feel about sport. And I think that's the most interesting thing to me. Like, I think my favorite sports writing isn't about sport at all. It's about people, you know, the people for the most part who are outside the white lines and who are looking in, you know, the people like us in a way, and the people who listen to your show as well.
Yeah. Well, Tadhg, you mentioned earlier on actually that we've published one of your essays that is under the Bylands Project. So everyone listening to this will have access to that. So you can drop us a line if you haven't already found it. Tadhg, thank you so much for doing the show. That was a real pleasure.
Thanks, Gavin. It was great. Really, really enjoyed it. Thanks a million.
Thanks so much to Tadhg. And thanks again to you for listening and indeed for supporting the show. And the 42, we hope you're keeping safe and well. We're going to be back next week with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.